Will Florida felons be able to vote in November? A court may decide that soon. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Amendment 4 gave felons their voting rights back, but it only applies to those who paid their fines and fees. The ACLU is fighting that in court. Anyone can follow the case online, and we'll get the latest. Also, we say farewell to WLRN reporter Nadege Green, who spent 5 years covering social justice issues. We reflected on some of her important stories over the years and her final project about a piece of Miami history.
My family is a family from Alabama. So to get to Miami was to get to the promised land.
Finally, how is the pandemic impacting the real estate market? We'll talk with some brokers about buying, selling, and taking your questions. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us today. The federal courts are among the many essential businesses still conducting work during the pandemic. And like a lot of us, judges, attorneys, and clerks are doing it virtually. On Monday, a federal court started hearing arguments in a high-profile case affecting hundreds of thousands of Floridians. Former felons regained the right to vote in November of 2018 after Floridians overwhelmingly voted in support of Amendment 4. However, the state has argued part of the language included in that bill, that felons must complete all terms of sentence, means they have to pay back all fines and fees due to the state. The plaintiffs in the case, led by the ACLU, are arguing that requirement is unconstitutional. WLRN's Danny Rivero joins us now via Skype to talk about this. Danny, great to have you.
Great to be on.
So this is a story you've been following for a while, but remind us about the controversy around these four words, all terms of sentence.
Right. So in the bill, in the amendment that was passed by about 65% of Floridians, it said people will get their voting rights restored if they complete all terms of the sentence. At the time it was passed, there actually was no standard definition of what all terms of a sentence means. So the legislature came in the legislative session soon after that, and they passed a bill. They passed a bill, SB 7066, it's called. And one of the things that bill did is that it actually put a definition on what all terms of a sentence did. And they said that what that means is that in order to complete your sentence, it's not just serving any prison time you have, any probation, any other kinds of state observation, that it means that if there's any money connected to your case, if that's paying court costs, paying the cost of prosecution, paying fines that are associated with the charge, paying restitution to victims, all of that is included in that term, all terms of a sentence. And for some people, it's relatively easy to pay if you're someone of some means and you can pay a couple hundred dollars. Well, you can get your right restored pretty immediately. But it's really become an issue for people who don't have easy access to money and who might owe more than they can realistically ever pay within decades or even a lifetime in some cases.
And there are 17 plaintiffs. They're being represented by lawyers with the ACLU. What's their argument? What are they arguing against these fines and fees?
So they are arguing that it's kind of a two-tiered argument. The one part is that these fines and fees and financial obligations are not part of the sentence. They've never been understood to be a part of a sentence. And the other part is that when the legislature passed this, one of the arguments is that it was discriminatory because primarily African Americans are disproportionately represented in this class of people with felony convictions, and especially represented in the class of people that don't have a lot of income. It's very hard to get a good paying job when you get out of prison, especially with a felony conviction, even more so if you have several felony convictions. So the argument is that this creates essentially a lifetime sentence because someone will never be able to vote again simply because they owe some amount of money that they are not in any reasonable way able to pay.
And the defendant is the state of Florida. What's their argument in favor of having to have felons repay these fines and fees?
So the argument of the state of Florida is that basically what the legislature did in defining all terms of a sentence, their argument is essentially that they were working off of Amendment 4 themselves. They're saying we weren't altering it, we weren't doing anything. You know, they've said in court this was a generation changing thing that that Florida voters passed. We wanted to we totally respect it. And then when we came in and drew the definition, we drew the definition, but that definition was basically parallel to what voters originally passed.
And do we know how much, by the way, felons owe the state of Florida? Do we have an idea of the fines and fees owed?
So there's a very rough estimation. Well over $1 billion we know is owed if you do it all across the state, and that's just in fines alone. And then every jurisdiction, every circuit, you know, here in South Florida, it's basically every county has their own fees that they tack onto it. There's, if there's a victim of a crime, that's something else. That money is not tracked anywhere. So it's just some imaginary number that we know is probably very, very big, but we don't have any way to track it.
So the judge that's presiding over this trial, U.S. District Judge Robert Hinkle, what do we know about his trial history or how the courts have landed on voting rights in the past?
Right. So this district, the Northern District of Florida, this case is happening out of Tallahassee. This district has, it's been frustrating to Florida lawmakers because it's repeatedly ruled against various things when it comes to voting rights. This was the same court, not the same judge, but the same court that struck down Florida's Board of Clemency process under Governor Rick Scott.
And that was that's how people, felons, would try to get their voting rights back. They had to go through the board, through the governor.
Exactly. And in that case, and that was upheld by a federal appeals court, and it said, this was just very politicized, it was arbitrary, and basically no elected official should have that much authority to say just on a case-by-case basis who should get the right to vote. So this case is kind of following in the heels of that as being the primary place where these arguments are taking place in Florida.
I'm talking with WLRN reporter Danny Rivero. Again, on Monday, arguments began in federal court surrounding the right to vote for hundreds of thousands of felons living in Florida. And you could read Danny's full story and all of his reporting on this. Go to WLRN.org. Okay, so Danny, I mean, this is a high-profile federal court case. States are watching this. A lot of states are watching this. And usually they would be in a court, having the trial in a courtroom. But because of COVID, everything's virtual, right?
Yeah, it's fun. It's actually kind of exciting because, in normal times, because this is happening in the Northern District of Florida, I would have to be in a courtroom in Tallahassee in order to watch this in real time. And the judge and the attorneys and witnesses and plaintiffs, they're all logging in by a video feed. We don't have access to the video feed, but they have provided a line that the public can call into and listen in real time. So it's actually a lot easier to access than it would be if it was in normal circumstances.
So anybody could just call in and listen to this happen.
Yeah, it's great. It's a kind of high drama of the kind you rarely get on a phone call. It hasn't been easy, and sometimes there's been some technological errors. Just about an hour ago, there was a mysterious beep that started happening. It sounded like someone was getting a call, and everyone was hearing it, and the judges saying, like, everyone moot your phone, which is kind of funny because moot's actually a legal word. Like, he doesn't know how to say mute or something. So there's been like little moments of entertainment happening throughout. But it is running surprisingly smooth, I would say.
So what are you keeping an eye out for over these next couple of weeks during this trial?
We haven't heard up to this point any defendants, anyone representing the state take the stand. We do know that some people at the Department of State and the Division of Elections are going to take the stand at some point and start talking from their perspective. Up to this point, we've mostly heard witnesses that were called from the plaintiffs, making their argument about why this is discriminatory and why the law did not make any objective sense. We haven't heard the other side yet. So that's really still to come.
And again, this could affect hundreds of thousands of people and their ability to vote in the upcoming August and November elections. And as I mentioned, a lot of states are watching very carefully what happens with this trial. Again, WLRN reporter Danny Rivero talking about the Amendment 4 trial that you can call in and listen to if you'd like to. Danny, thanks so much.
Thank you, Lewis.
And you can follow all of his reporting at WLRN.org. Well, still to come, we say farewell to a voice you are very familiar with, WLRN's Nadege Green. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, we're going to be saying goodbye to reporter Nadege Green. For 5 years, she's covered so many amazing stories, issues like gun violence, race, and justice. Some of our most notable series, her notable series, include In Your Own Words, Young Survivors, and There Goes the Neighborhood Miami, which you can find all of it on our website, WLRN.org. Her work has been recognized locally and nationally for its impact on the community, including an ACLU of Greater Miami Chapter Gene Miller Voice of Freedom Award. And she has her last story coming out next week, and it'll be on this show. It tells us about the history of an Allapattah neighborhood called Railroad Shop Colored Edition. We talked to Nadege yesterday and reflected on some of the work that she did during her time here, beginning with an explanation of her In Your Own Words project.
So In Your Own Words is specifically a series on community members who've lost school-age kids to gun violence. And the reason I started this project was because I would go out and interview folks around stories after shootings. And I just noticed that there was so much that didn't make it into the stories, that some of these families had so much to say about who this young person was and what they meant to them. And I thought that it would be really powerful. And I also thought it would be really good, not just for the families, right, to talk about this, but also for our listeners and for people to engage with stories around gun violence differently. You know, when King Carter was killed, he was the six-year-old who was shot and killed. I talked to his aunt.
I was flipping through his compositional book, and I guess the teacher assigned them, when I grow up, I want to be. That stood out because I'm like, somebody silence your dream. Somebody silence your dream.
And, you know, she spoke to me about, you know, what he wanted to be when he grew up and going through his last journals. And I think too often when we talk about gun violence, we don't humanize who we're talking about. You know, we just hear someone was shot or a kid was shot and that's the end. But through this series, In Their Own Words, you heard from family members directly on like just who these young people were for them and what they meant to them. And, you know, it was an in memoriam through the family members.
So you had that series, and there was another series, Young Survivors, and this looks at people who survived gun violence. Where did the inspiration come from?
I mean, I was covering gun violence as an issue from the first day I got into WLRN. I knew that I wanted to talk about gun violence differently than what we typically see or hear in the media. I think too often gun violence stories around shootings in our communities center around the initial crime. Like this crime happened, police made arrest, didn't make an arrest, you call this tip line. And that's normally where the story ends. Every now and then you might see a few stories about a trial, but there's very little that talks about the in-between, what it means to survive this, like what happens after the police tape, you know, disappears? What happens after, for all intents and purposes, the media disappears? Like, what is the reality for these families? So from the day I got to WLRN, I knew I wanted to approach stories around gun violence with a more human-centered lens, that this isn't just a crime story. This is a story about trauma. This is a story about health. This is a story about urban planning. This is a story about education. I mean, it touches all facets of our community. And I just wanted the fullness and the humanity of the communities that are impacted by gun violence to be seen differently. So I think the first story I pitched for WLRN, one of my first was about a mass shooting that happened in Liberty City. And I stayed in the community for several months following the aftermath of this mass shooting. I was embedded with a pastor. I was able to go to some of the funerals. You know, I spoke with community members who were going out at that point every single week to protest the gun violence. And one of the things that we found in the Young Survivor series, certainly, you know, I was one of the lead reporters on it, but I wasn't the only reporter on the Young Survivor series. Our former colleague, Sammy Mack, who was the health reporter here, was on that series, and the former education reporter, Rowan Moore Garrity, also worked on that series. But one of the things we initially found as we started digging, because the story wasn't supposed to be young survivors, we were actually looking at deaths around gun violence. And we got a piece of data that really made us re-envision how we wanted to tell the story from Jackson Memorial Hospital. And when we got those numbers back, one of the things we saw was, wait, most of the people who get shot survive. Most of the people who get shot live. And so we ended up pivoting our stories, and the series ended up looking at what does it mean to live, right, with gun violence. So we spent time, you know, with a young man who was left paraplegic after being shot in high school. We talked about what it means to survive from the lens of students who've lost friends to gun violence. So you're living after your friends, you're showing up to class and your friends are no longer there. What does it mean to live after you've lost your friends to gun violence?
Both of those series, truly powerful and online, so people definitely should check them out. But you also did a lot of fun stuff. You know, you covered dance, by the way, beautifully, as you yourself are a dancer, and you covered food. You did this great story about Bickley's, but just remind us again of why it is such an important thing.
I guess my reporting has like run the gamut on like just the things I report on are very serious, you know, talk about gun violence and housing equity and really heavy topics that touch on issues around inequality and inequities in our communities. But every now and then I do like to dabble in things that aren't as heavy, and it's necessary to sort of span out and just, you know, take a brain break, if I can call it that, and just do something lighter. So I did dabble, and I love food reporting. It, you know, everyone in the newsroom knows that I like to eat. So Pickley's was a fun story to talk about, this Haitian condiment that is widespread throughout Miami-Dade County. It's a spicy vinegar slaw that I grew up eating because I'm of Haitian descent. But I went out and I reported on how all of these non-Haitian restaurants have also discovered the magic of Pickley's and are adding it to their menus. So it's just a lovely, like, you know, slice of life story. I was born and raised here in Miami. And one of the things I love about our community is that, you know, so we meld and merge in some very interesting ways.
There was that. And I got to tell you, you're the one who got me to drink Saracy tea, and I'm going to tell you to this day, still the worst thing I've ever tasted, but that was a lot of fun, you know, learning about it.
Yeah, you know, again, one of the things that I love about, you know, where we live is just how people live and how we live with this place. So the Saracy tea story, or Asosi as it's known in Creole, was this very like Caribbean plant all throughout the Caribbean, especially the English-speaking Caribbean, and in Haiti. Folks use Saracy, this vine that grows wild here in Miami, for medicinal purposes. And you'll, you know, in some neighborhoods, you'll see like aunties and such walking around with plastic bags just pulling at these random leaves. And you're like, what are they doing? I'm like, oh, they see a plant they know from home and they're going to use it for something. And so Asosi, or Saracy tea, it's one of those things that, you know, if you're part of this community, you know what it's for and you know how it's used. But if you're not, you're like, this looks a little strange, you know. So I love being able to connect, you know, the things that make us who we are in our community. And it was great to see your face, Lewis, when you drank a cup.
Sadly, there is a video of me drinking that. And yes, that is about as bad a face as I can make. I'm speaking with WLRN reporter Nadege Green. She's leaving our newsroom after spending 5 years covering social justice issues in South Florida. You can find her stories at WLRN.org. Before we let you go, I wanted to ask you about you know, your most recent story. I want you to take us back through the history of the Railroad Shop Colored Edition Allapattah neighborhood and tell me about this final project that you're working on for us.
So this is my last story for WLRN, and this story is on the Railroad Shop Colored Edition neighborhood. It is a neighborhood that was created around 1917, when Miami was only just about 21 years old. It was a neighborhood of all Black folks. And this story looks at the history of what happened to this neighborhood. Some of the descendants and families of Railroad Shop, a few of them are still alive. And I went back and I interviewed, you know, these Black families about having their land taken from them. Ultimately, the families of Railroad Shop would end up getting kicked out.
One of them was Geraldine Owens. She was a child when this happened. Let's hear a little bit of her story.
It was August 1st. And it was storming. And my grandfather, Malachi, he refused to move. I remember this big, fat, white police. And he had a shotgun. And he had on beige pants, and he had that shotgun. And he called my grandfather, Mr. Mr. Malachi, you got to go. And I was just crying, Papa, he gonna kill you, Papa. I thought he was gonna kill him.
But it's a story that looks at, you know, the fraught relationship with our history here in Miami-Dade County, but really throughout the country when it came to Black land ownership, who gets to stay and who is forced to go. And the politics around why Black communities are moved often in mass, right? In the case of Railroad Shop, it was because the all-white community that surrounded it wanted them gone. And when you talk about displacement, that leaves a permanent scar, right? It's a wound that doesn't really heal for so many families to have to pick up and just go with little or no notice and rebuild your entire life off of land that you owned. So this story looks at, you know, this very real Miami history around a neighborhood that was erased, and the efforts to keep the history of this story alive through the people who used to live there. It's not an unknown story. I mean, there are folks in Miami who know about Railroad Shop, especially in some of Miami's Black communities, but it's definitely not one of the better known stories. You know, when we talk about displacement in Miami, I think the story that typically first comes to mind is, you know, Overtown and I-95 tearing through Overtown and destroying that community, and how the landowners in Overtown were displaced to create I-95. Like, that's a pretty well-known story in Miami around, you know, what government-sanctioned land taking in a Black community looks like, right? Railroad Shop preceded what happened in Overtown by many years, right? So in a lot of ways, Railroad Shop came first. I mean, Railroad Shop absolutely came first. So it's one of the first examples in Miami's history of mass displacement of a Black community through eminent domain, which is when the government takes your property for so-called public good.
So Nadezh, as you said, you know, this is a story in history that's not really well known. The second half of this, you introduce us to the one person who wanted to preserve the history, Georgia Ayers. Why did you want to tell this story and highlight her contributions?
I mean, you really can't talk about Railroad Shop and not talk about Georgia Ayers. Georgia Ayers was born in Railroad Shop, and she was one of the most prominent members, you know, of Black Miami, who always brought up the neighborhood. I mean, everywhere she went, she talked about Railroad Shop, and she made sure that it was in the consciousness of the folks that she spoke to, because Georgia Ayers recognized that this was a piece of history that could easily be lost.
Nadezh, we both came to WLRN the same year, and I think just by a matter of weeks, you know, difference. And I got to tell you, like, when I first met you, I gravitated towards you. You are a person. And I think one of the things I respect most about you is you're not shy. You will speak your mind. I'm a different type of person. I tend to hold back. And I think that's why I gravitated towards you. And I've always wanted to ask you this. What is it that motivates you? What drives you?
It's so funny you say that, Louis, because I actually am shy. Like, I'm not like the out there person in, I guess, my personal world. But certainly, you know, when it comes to work and just, you know, caring about, you know, the issues that I cover, you have to speak up. And I think that's just important. You know, you have a platform that you use it for good. The communities I cover are often described as, you know, voiceless. And I often push back. I'm like, they're not voiceless. The communities I cover have voices. They can speak just fine. They're just typically not heard, right? Like, there's an active choice not to listen. And so I just, you know, I think it's important that, you know, we don't just do the easy stories or the most accessible stories, but that we actually take the time out to speak to the various communities that call South Florida home, and not just the ones that are easy to reach, or the ones that, you know, have internet access, or the ones who only speak English, that we have to make the time and meet people where they are, which is why I love public media, right? That we spend time with people and we tell people stories, because that is just very important to me.
That is now former WLRN reporter Nadej Green. Nadej, I can speak for the rest of the station. I think I can speak for the listeners too. We are going to miss you a lot. And by the way, let me make a note. I said 5 years? No, she's been with us 6 years. Remember, you could always read some of her past coverage on our website, WLRN.org. And next week on our program, you're going to hear her last story. And you could follow her on social media to see her next career move. So stay tuned. Well, still to come, how stay-at-home orders has changed the way we buy and sell homes. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Has your one-bedroom apartment started to feel a little cramped during the stay-at-home orders? Are you craving a house for you and your family, a little more space, maybe a backyard? Maybe you're looking to downsize and get some extra money for your home as we continue to ride out this very shaky market. Well, real estate is a significant part of the South Florida economy. People are continuing to buy and sell homes during the pandemic, believe it or not, albeit the process is a lot different than it was just a few months ago. And we want to hear from you. Are you selling or buying a home? How has the process changed during the pandemic? Give us a call, 800-743-9576. That's 800-743-9576. Also, if you happen to be a real estate agent, what's it been like for you? We want to hear your story. Also, email us if you can't get through, sundial@wlrnnews.org. Well, joining me now is Nancy Clock Corey. She's a Coldwell Banker, residential real estate agent, and regional VP for Southeast Florida. Nancy, great to have you. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Louis. It's a pleasure. Absolutely a pleasure.
And also joining us is Chad Gray. He's a broker with Luxury Living Fort Lauderdale with Compass. Chad, thanks for joining us today.
Happy to be here, Louis.
So I want to get this sense from both of you right now as to what's going on. Nancy, I'll start with you. I mean, we're seeing, not just in the state of Florida, we're seeing all over the country, record unemployment. And we've also seen that the news came out today that, you know, the last 6 years of what we built up in this economy is gone in just a month. So who's buying right now? Who's the clientele?
That's a good question. And actually, what we're seeing is a lot of movement in the very, very high end. That, you know, obviously speaks contrary to the problem with unemployment. And I believe the reason for that is capital shift, and the drivers that were in the market are still there that started before this began. But I think that everything will need to flush out. It really depends on how many of those jobs and how quickly they're able to get those jobs back in. We had similar situations in our past real estate history where we had people that had difficulty with mortgages and all of those different things that occurred at that time. And I believe that most of the lenders all took that into account. So, you know, hopefully the lenders will feel that way as they move forward, that this was a break in history and it was something that occurred globally, obviously, but certainly within our local community. And that would be factored in. So I think you're going to see, you know, a little bit of flexing, or hopefully a little bit of flexing on the part of the lenders to help these folks out.
And I want to ask about the banks, but, you know, again, talking about who's buying and selling, are you seeing more locals who are just moving around, or more people from out of state? And I can't imagine we're seeing too many internationals.
Interesting is a combination of all of those. There's still very good movement from other parts of the country, although, you know, showings are obviously a bit more creative now and getting exposure to the property is a little bit more creative now. But we're certainly seeing very strong movement from around the country and the normal local activity. The foreign buying population had reduced, you know, a little bit, but we're actually getting interest and traction from places like Brazil and South America for the first time in a while, and a little bit of activity from Europe, but not so much. So, you know, it depends on which demographic you're looking at. The very high end, you know, they're operating in discretionary spending, and so therefore, you know, they'll continue their plans.
Chad, she talked about lenders, the banks, lenders. What are they doing in this environment? You know, have they changed their process? Are they getting tighter, maybe a little looser? What about, you know, like first down payment? What, you know, are they kind of, you know, loosening up those kind of requirements?
Well, I wouldn't say they're loosening it up, but the silver lining in all of this is that mortgage rates are actually at historic lows, and they're predicted to go down even lower in 2021. So that's the good news. The bad news is, depending upon the loan program that you're applying for, the guidelines are tighter. So that could mean a larger down payment, higher credit scores, lower debt-to-income ratios, more reserves needed after closing. They're also doing employment re-verification, meaning that they actually check that you're still employed on the day of closing. So that's become super important. And then also for self-employed borrowers, they're having to prove that they're currently making money during this pandemic.
So it sounds like they're getting a little bit tighter, a little stingier.
Yeah, definitely, for sure. And it does depend on the program, but I know that, for example, jumbo lending, loan amounts above the loan amount of $510,000, those have become more strict. And as a matter of fact, some banks actually have stopped doing them momentarily.
Again, we want to hear from you. Are you buying or selling a home in this market? Wondering how this pandemic has changed the process for you. Give us a call, 800-743-9576. Again, that's 800-743-9576. You can always email us, sundial@wlrnnews.org. Before I go to the phones, though, real quickly, Nancy, Chad, I saw a Gallup poll that shows people are becoming more pessimistic about the market. And they're starting to think, you know what, this is going to get worse, maybe. And so let's just wait, and housing costs are going to go down. But Nancy, I'll start with you. What are you hearing?
I don't find it unusual that they are getting pessimistic. I think that's more, you know, a condition of being trapped in their homes for this extended period of time. We're actually not seeing that. In fact, we're seeing more activity now than we have in past weeks. We're seeing more inquiries from the internet. We're seeing more buyers that are actively looking and pushing to be able to get the opportunity to be able to see inside homes. By the way, it's nice to have you on the program, Chad, and hello. Chad will probably,
yeah,
you know, agree with me. Good to hear from you. I think okay. that, you know, the consumers that wanted and needed to purchase before this occurred, you know, that will come back. To what extent that will and at what rate that will, you know, remains to be seen. But yeah. I haven't necessarily seen a lowering in the appetite for buying.
Chad, what are you seeing? Because you cover a lot more of the Broward County market. What, you know, is the Gallup poll wrong? Are people not pessimistic? They're still optimistic?
Well, I wouldn't say that people are becoming more pessimistic, but I would say that, you know, I'm out there talking to buyers and sellers every day during this pandemic, and what I'm finding is that buyers are calling in and they're really expecting a deal, and they're expecting a deal now, and sellers are just not there yet. And so it's been a challenge because, you know, we're sort of just knocking heads right now because buyers are making offers, and they're making low offers, lower probably than what they should be right now, and sellers are just not even entertaining them. So that's what I'm finding right now. But with that being said, pending sales are down 60% for the most part in all in the Tri-County area. And closed transactions, homes that have already sold, are down nearly 50%. So we've definitely seen a shift in the market. And we do feel that probably will, you know, adjust prices downward.
Yeah, and we'll talk about, you know, speculating for the future here in a little bit. I want to go to the phones. I want to start with David in Pompano Beach. David, welcome to the program, and hopefully, if you're in this process, it's going okay for you. What's going on, David?
Oh, thank you very much. My process is a little different. I actually want to build a home. I've found a builder, and we've agreed on a price and everything like that. I sold my home recently in Pompano Beach, and I had a very good credit score, but because I have no debt, now the banks are unable to develop a credit score for me, and I'm having trouble getting a loan.
All right, no debt, wants to build a home. Nancy or Chad, either one of you jump in. You got a take on that?
I would say probably both of us have recommendations of people that he can chat with to try to support and help him with his specific circumstances. Certainly offline, you can get my information. Chad, I'm sure you have some resources as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I would put you in touch with someone that could potentially help you. And then, but, you know, that is a challenging situation. But I think we could put you in touch with someone that could help your situation.
Help me understand, though. David's paid off his debt. Why would he have trouble getting a loan?
Lenders want credit history. They want to see that he has had that in the past and he has paid it. I say kudos to you, David, for doing what you have. And also, I think in this current environment, you probably have to check around a lot more because some of the big house lenders have, you know, temporarily just shut down. So you may have hit a pocket where your normal lending channels aren't open, but there are others. And, you know, certainly if Chad or I can assist you in that, we're more than happy to do so.
All right, David, thank you so much. I'm going to put you on hold, David. I'll get your information.
Okay.
And thank you so much for that. And best of luck to you. Let me go back to the phones. I want to go to Caroline in Fort Lauderdale. Caroline, welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What's going on with you?
So I was just calling to comment on Chad's comment in regards to employment verification. My husband and I were denied for a jumbo loan due to my temporary furlough due to COVID-19. Last week we were approved when I was employed, and this week we went for a pre-approval for a different home, and we were denied because I could not verify employment on the day of the pre-approval request. So they are getting very strict about requesting that employment verification.
Nancy, it's something you said a moment ago got me thinking. I mean, it's, you know, these are unique circumstances. You know, so would a bank or lender put that into consideration? Like, it's a unique circumstance. I mean, they got furloughed, but then again, this is, you know, it wasn't like they were being irresponsible. It's a pandemic.
Absolutely. I would never speak for a lender, but certainly I think, Caroline, if you have a good, strong history in the same industry and good, strong employment records, the lender may be just temporarily nervous and want you to have a date or some type of letter from your employer saying that you're coming back. You weren't laid off. You were furloughed. So I think that is a different situation. I don't have specific information since I'm not a lender, a direct lender myself, but I can certainly find out that answer and get that back to you because I think it is an interesting question. My comment was more from a historical standpoint,
yeah,
that when a lender is moving forward and things get back to whatever they get back to, you know, they'll be able to look at the broader picture and make better decisions then. You know, I'm very sorry to hear that happen to you, Caroline. And once again, I think both Chad and I can at least try to give you a couple of other resources to see if there's any way that someone can help you.
Chad, what are you telling people right now if they find themselves in a situation like Caroline? I mean, is there a hope for getting a lender to say yes, or is it a matter of, well, you're going to have to wait this out?
Well, you know, I think it's, you know, it can come down to different lenders are going to tell you some different things. And whereas a local bank actually might be a better option for that versus a lender. But, you know, I've been advising buyers in the, you know, to start the pre-approval process early. And since banks are being more restrictive, it's important for people to get all of their ducks in a row up front prior to them wanting to move forward in the home buying process so that when the opportunity arises, when they find the home that they really want to move forward on, they'll be ready.
All right. Caroline, if you want to send us an email, sundial@wlrnnews.org, And let's see if we can't help connect you with them and see if maybe find an answer there. But best of luck to you as well as you're going through this. And again, the number is 800-743-9576 or email us, sundial@wlrnnews.org. You know, Nancy, I wonder how the virus is affecting home appraisal values. How are those values affecting refinancing, you know, short mortgage rates, things like that?
That's also a very good question. The appraisals have really adapted. The appraisers have adapted. Some of them are using the homeowners on FaceTime, WhatsApp video, Zoom, Teams, those you know, products in order to be able to view the inside of the home. And some of them have adapted to drive-by appraisals because the information that they get, with the exception of knowing that the home, you know, is in decent condition inside the property, they're basically valuing the property still based on closed sales. And since the closed sales are historical and those occurred, you know, 30, maybe 60 days ago when they went under contract, it hasn't really impacted them yet. As we move forward, if the closed sales start changing or trending in a different direction, I do believe you'll see a change there. The refinance market has gone crazy. Our mortgage company is extremely active right now and very busy. In fact, they had to separate the two, you know, job functions, and, you know, they have one area that just handles finance now and one that handles the new loans because the refinances were up so high. So I think a lot of lenders, to Chad's point earlier, are, you know, seeing the advantage of these interest rates, not sure how long they may last, and opting to refinance now, you know, while they can.
Yeah. Let me go back to the phones. I want to go to Kareem in Fort Lauderdale. Kareem, thanks for waiting. Welcome.
Hey, thank you for taking my call. How are you guys doing today?
Trying to stay safe as best we can. But are you a first-time home buyer?
I am looking forward to buy my first-time home buyer, and it's very disturbing to hear that they're getting a little bit more stricter on the guidelines on the path of getting it. And I just want to know, how is that going to affect when people go to the first-time homebuyer class, they complete the program, and they got their credit score? How are they going to look at the first-time homebuyer community and to relax the nervousness of this news that I'm hearing?
Yeah. Chad, what's going to happen with first-time homebuyers? How's the pandemic impacting them?
I don't know that there's been a massive impact, actually, which I think is a good thing. FHA is always a great mortgage program for first-time home buyers, which is as little as 3.5% down, and they're a little less stringent on credit scores. I haven't necessarily heard a whole lot that FHA has changed their guidelines, and if they have, I think they've just been really minimal. And so I would suggest just going to get pre-approved from a local lender and asking about an FHA program.
All right. So again, for Kareem, again, a first-time home buyer. So he's talking about the FHA loans. Has that changed, by the way, Chad, with the usually going with a low down payment? That hasn't changed?
No, not that I'm aware of. I'm not aware of any down payment changes.
All right. Kareem, thank you so much for the call. Again, we're talking about how the pandemic is impacting buying and selling homes. Now, as we heard, sales of homes have gone down. Prices really haven't yet. And we've only been in the pandemic for a little while, but how is that going to impact the market in the coming months? Again, we're joined by Nancy Clark Corey. She's with Caldwell. And we're also talking with Chad Gray, who's with Compass. And we want to hear from you. What are your questions? Maybe you're buying, maybe you're selling, you're thinking about it. What's concerning you during this pandemic? 800-743-9576. Or you can email us, sundial@wlrnnews.org. Nancy, is this a better time if you're a buyer, or is it better if you're a seller right now?
I think that anytime you're buying and selling in the real estate market, it is strictly a supply-demand question, because if you're, for example, going into a specific building and just want that building, that's very different than if you want a specific type of unit, bedrooms, baths, views, square footage, and you're looking across several buildings or in an area. Some areas, I call them sort of pocket areas, where they're holding up you know, prices very well within that subdivision, then you'll be going to another one and they're not holding up so well. So it really depends on the supply-demand factor. And I will say, although this seems self-serving, you need a good real estate professional now more than you ever have, because you have to know the current information that's going on in the marketplace, and they know. You know, they dig deep, they drill deep. You should get a good referral if you don't know somebody personally, because you must have all the facts and information in order for you to make a good decision. And then at the end of the day, Lewis, the chances are you will buy and sell based on your wants and needs. And, you know, it could be anything from schools to proximity to walkability to all kinds of things factor into the decision to buy and sell a home. And most of the time people start the process, you know, thinking strictly about the economics. But at the end of the process, they will choose based on what's good for them, what they can afford, and what they have a tolerance for.
Okay.
But it always goes down to supply and demand, just like the stock market.
All right. I want to go back to the phones. I want to go to Elizabeth in Key West. Elizabeth, welcome to the program.
Hi, this is my first time ever calling into the radio.
All right. Well, welcome. Tell us what's going on. Thanks. With you. What's on your mind?
I have been looking to buy for many years. One of the issues we have down here is that we still have houses that are owned by banks from Wilma. And so the banks are holding on to zombie houses to kind of prop up property values down here. That's always beautiful.
Mm.
So they artificially keep the
right. No.
The supply low.
So you're in the,
yeah, the demand is high.
Are you in the process of wanting to buy a place now?
Oh yes. Yes, I've been looking here and I've been going up and up and up the coast.
Okay.
Also, and speaking about the agent who just said you need a good agent, I learned in all of this mine's a buyer only agent, the fellow that I'm working with, like, because otherwise they can work both sides or something, and so you need to really be sure that they're working for you and you alone,
right?
Not kind of in between. But
so real quickly, do you have a question?
The fellow was saying about people making low bids on houses and it's too low and stuff. Since nobody knows, but you've been saying it the whole time, nobody knows what's going on. So the buyer is taking a lot of risk.
Okay. Elizabeth, I'll just cut you off for a second, only because of time. All right. So real quickly, Chad, because Nancy was talking about who's got the advantage here, buyers or sellers. But let me get your take on that, kind of what Elizabeth's talking about here with, you know, in this market, you know, is the buyer feeling a little bit squeamish about, you know, moving forward? What are you seeing when it comes to that process?
Yeah, so buyers, as I said earlier, are definitely expecting a good deal. I mean, they really feel like prices are going to come down pretty substantially. And so the buyers I've been talking to now are making offers that are like, you know, in some cases 10 or 15% lower than what they're listed for, which is pretty substantial. And they feel that their offer amount is warranted based on what they think the market will fall in the coming months. And so from their perspective, they feel like it's a good, solid offer. But in the seller's perspective, it's way off. But statistically speaking, we are in a buyer's market. We had transitioned already over to a buyer's market. And now I would say that we are in a strong buyer's market.
Okay. I want, because of time, I'm going to finish up with both of you on this. You're both optimistic. I've talked to you about the market. You're both optimistic. But I'm going to give you a little pushback here. If things continue the way they are, Nancy, I'll start with you. What's your biggest concern for the next 6 months?
The biggest concern is obviously the health consideration. I mean, the thing that keeps me up at night is the health and safety of our sales associates, especially as they, you know, go out into the market and they start to engage more with the public. You know, that's the thing I worry about most. You know, as far as the economics and all those types of things, you know, one way or another, it work its way through. But my biggest fear is that we go out too quickly, our agents go out too quickly, put themselves at risk, put the consumers at risk. So to tell you the truth, that's my biggest concern.
And Chad, what about you?
I would say that as well as the unemployment. I mean, I just keeps going up and up and up. And I think I saw today that it's now at 26 million people. And that, you know, that I think that's really going to affect and impact our market. It's super hard to predict, you know, what will happen because we've never been in a situation like this. But yeah, the unemployment just creeping up every single week is very, very concerning, and it will certainly have an impact on real estate.
And you are right. We have not, we've been through hurricanes, we've been through wars, we've been through recessions. We have not been through anything like this. So we'll keep our fingers crossed. It is not going to be terrible. But again, I want to thank Chad Gray, broker with Luxury Living Fort Lauderdale. That's with Compass. Also, Nancy Clark Corey, Caldwell Banker, residential real estate agent, regional VP for Southeast Florida, again for Caldwell. Nancy, Chad, thank you so much. Both of you, stay safe.
Thank you, Louis.
Thank you, Louis. Well. Thanks for having us.
And that's our program for this Thursday, April 30th. Coming up next week on Sundial, Goodwill is an essential nonprofit for many struggling to get basic clothes and supplies. The organization can't keep all their workers employed and provide those goods. We're going to have a conversation with the president and CEO of Goodwill South Florida. Plus, doctors at the University of Miami have begun research on stem cell treatment for the coronavirus. It involves taking stem cells from the umbilical cords and injecting them into patients. We're going to find out more about that. And then finally, parents across South Florida have been working with their children on homework assignments for over a month, and they're struggling. Could they learn something from homeschoolers, people who've been doing it for a while? We're going to chat with a Fort Lauderdale-based homeschooling company about best practices, and we're going to take your questions. Maybe they've got a little advice for you. Well, that's the program for this week. I'm Louis Hernandez. Remember, have a great Friday, a great weekend. Stay safe, and we'll talk to you again live on Monday.